Hello, friends, and welcome to the Healing Ground Movement. Now, for more content and bonus features, you can join us on Facebook and Instagram. And remember, all of our content is delivered freely, so please consider supporting the show by donating via the link on our website at healinggroundmovement.com or liking and reviewing the podcast on your favorite platform.
Enjoy today's episode.
Today's episode is brought to you by one of my all-time favorite apps, Blinkist. I found out about this app when I was pregnant and didn't have as much time to read, particularly into those early years of mothering, and it has been a game changer. Blinkist brings you knowledge from top nonfiction and podcasts so you can learn anytime, anywhere, and the best part is it condenses it down into 15 minutes. You can either listen or read to key ideas from best-selling nonfiction in just 15 minutes. So you keep getting all of these great recommendations, all the parenting books, all the health books, all of the things that you know you should be doing and know that you should know more about, but you just don't have the time to read the full version. You can get the Cliff Notes version from Blinkist. They have teamed up with podcast creators to bring you key insights from podcasts as well. And there is expert curation, their handpicked recommendation tailored to what you're interested in. So the more you listen, the more specific your recommendations get. Visit healinggroundmovement.com/resources for a free trial of Blinkist. I know you're going to love it as much as I do. Enjoy today's episode. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Healing Ground Movement podcast. I am your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, and with us today we have Dr. David Feigenbaum. Now, Dr. Feigenbaum has a really interesting personal story of his own that I'm so excited to get to share with you. He has a book, Chasing My Cure, Sharing Lessons Learned About Life from Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. And so a lot of times on this podcast, we talk about lifestyle medicine and the type of work that we need to do in dealing with chronic diseases, where we can change that from our environment around us. But we also talk about using that emergency medical care when it is necessary, that it has that life-changing impact. You all know that from my bacterial meningitis, that was what gave me over that 5% chance of even being here to have these conversations with you today. And Dr. Feigenbaum has his own story of that nature as well. So I'm going to have him chime in here in a moment. But first, here is the official introduction. David Feigenbaum is a physician scientist at the University of Pennsylvania and a national best-selling author of Chasing My Cure. After nearly dying 5 times, Feigenbaum discovered a treatment that is saving his life and others. Now he is advancing drug repurposing for COVID-19 and other diseases through the Center for Cytokine Storm Treatment and Laboratory and Cure Drug Repurposing Collaboratory. That's a lot of big words for me to say this late in the afternoon, but Dr. Feigenbaum, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so glad to be here with you and excited to get the chance to chat about all the things we were speaking about before the podcast.
Thank you. I so enjoy having more perspectives in this way, because as we were chatting a little bit ahead, you know, particularly when you are in that position of having taken your whole life in your hands, and something that you and I, now I, at the time that I was directing my own care, I was not in a life and death situation. I was more in a quality of life situation. But when you take charge of directing your own care and seeking your own answers, it really puts you in this place of it's a unique place of doctor and patient, and the perspective that comes along with that. So I'm so excited to have you share that with the listeners and to invite you to get started. Can you give us a little bit of the backstory that comes in Chasing My Cure?
Sure. So as you know, I was a healthy medical student. In my third year, I wanted to become an oncologist. My mom had passed away from cancer a few years before, and that really drove me to want to dedicate my life to try to find treatments for patients like my mom. Was well on my way to that dream when out of nowhere, I became critically ill. My liver, my kidneys, my bone marrow, my heart, my lungs just started to shut down. And you know, you might say, well, what does that actually feel like? Well, it started out by just feeling like the most intense fatigue that I had ever felt. I mean, it was like this like insatiable fatigue where I was just exhausted all day long. I would have tons and tons of coffees and was just constantly tired. I would have to take these naps between seeing patients. I would go from one patient room to another, and then I would find an empty hospital room and I would take a 5 minute nap and then go to the next room. I was just so exhausted. And then the fatigue turned into night sweats and started noticing lumps in my neck that turned out to be enlarged lymph nodes and horrible abdominal pain. And all of a sudden, with just in a couple of weeks of going from being totally healthy, I was a college football player. I even was a certified personal trainer. I was kind of as fit as you could be. I hadn't had a hamburger in about a decade. I mean, I literally was, you know, the cleanest eater, the healthiest person you can imagine. And all of a sudden I was, you know, literally dying in the intensive care unit with everything shutting down. And as you know, over the course of the next 6 months, I really drifted back and forth from the brink of death. I had my last rites read to me because my doctors didn't think I was going to survive. And so a priest came into my room and read my last rites to me, said goodbye to my family. Unfortunately, took weeks and weeks before the diagnosis was made. But fortunately, I was eventually diagnosed with a disease called idiopathic multicentric Castleman disease. Called idiopathic because we don't know what causes it. We don't know why the immune system does what it does, where it just attacks all of your vital organs. But thankfully, the diagnosis came just in time because I was able to be started on some treatments that saved my life. But unfortunately, I would go on to have a number of relapses.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that in and of itself is a huge journey. And I know that a lot of those relapses and pieces was at about a 5-year period of constantly working your way back and forth from the brink of death.
Yeah, it was. So at first, it was a 6-month period where I spent almost the entire 6 months hospitalized, most of that time in critical condition, but fortunately had some remission time in there where I was out. But really, it was about a 3.5-year period where, where I was back and forth between the hospital and health and illness. And actually, tomorrow we'll mark 100 months that I've been in remission. Tomorrow's a big milestone for me.
That's awesome. Congratulations on
that.
That's huge.
Thank you. I never like to round up. I usually would say today marks 99.97 months in remission. And because you can't guarantee anything, right? You know, I have no idea what tomorrow is going to hold. So I should go back on my statement. Today is 99.97. Let's hope tomorrow is 100.
That's beautiful. Well, and I think that sort of throws a little bit of a highlight on some of the perspective that comes after going through something like you've been through, which is nothing is guaranteed. And throughout your book, Chasing My Cure, you talk about a lot about interpersonal things going on in your life, some of your relationship with your now wife, Caitlin, and choices that you made at the start of your disease and how this perspective of going through this whole journey really made huge changes to what you prioritized, even before you hit that first solid remission.
That's right. I think that, you know, one of the main reasons why I wrote Chasing My Cure was really because of how fundamentally I've changed as a person based on my journey. And I thought to myself, gosh, I really wish I didn't have to have my last rites read to me and spend months and months hospitalized to learn this stuff. Like, it'd be really nice if I could just read it in a couple hundred pages. So yeah, that really is what drove me to want to write the book is that I did learn so many lessons about life. And in the book, I talk a lot about this feeling of being in overtime. You know, overtime in a sporting event is time that you didn't think you'd have, time where you're exhausted and you're sort of like, you know, you played your full game, but you have to stay on top of your A game. And, you know, a mistake that you make in overtime is really going to, you know, be the end. Whereas, you can make a mistake early on in a game and make up for it. And that can be really scary, right? To feel like, oh my gosh, I'm in overtime. Like, I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. But it can also be clarifying and saying, I'm in overtime, which means I don't know how much time I have left. I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. So I should really focus on making the most of today. And, you know, it's like such a cliche to say, you know, live like, you know, like today's your last, or I'm probably saying it the wrong way, but it's true. I think it's a cliche because it's true. And that's that, if you really live with the freedom of saying, like, I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. I don't know if I can round up to 100 months, but I'm going to use this to clarify how I should spend my time today.
I love it. And it is a cliche, but the more I talk to people who have been in the position of having narrowly escaped death, that there is this, gosh, it's like this insider's club nod of, these are all bonus days now. Yeah. I got sick when I was 7 months old. I've never really known anything but bonus days, but it's a whole different way of going into the world because you don't have this illusion of immortality. You don't have this illusion of needing to cling to everything so tightly because it's not guaranteed anyway. It's a double-edged sword in a way.
I totally agree with you. It's a double-edged sword, and but it's the kind of thing that you want to be sort of, as you said, kind of clued into early on so that you're not, you know, at the end of your time realizing that, oh my gosh, I should have, really, lived with a different mentality or mindset.
And in that way, you kind of come, as you talked about eating your burger, and that was a really poignant section in your book as well, is that first burger that you sat down and had, is finding that place for quality of life versus quantity of life and what that exchange of getting is. And it's a really narrow line that we talk about here on the podcast, because there is so much that lifestyle changes can do to improve your health and well-being. And yet on the other side, we can get neurotically attached to it, where the return on investment, you're just driving yourself crazy. And so you went from, this peak of your life health, which is almost an ironic thing to say, because given how Castleman's work, your immune system was already undermining this idea that you were in the peak of life health. You looked good, but your immune system wasn't there for you. How do you negotiate that to keep your health and well-being without that sort of overcommitting to how it should be done?
Yes. I mean, I think that as I've gotten older, I feel like it always seems that the answer is somewhere in the middle. I think that when it comes to health and wellness, it's somewhere in the middle, probably a lot closer towards the, make the right decisions, eating and acting and lifestyle choices for sure. But I don't know if it's all the way to your point at the very end of this big spectrum. So I'm not saying it's right in the middle, but I'm just saying it's somewhere in the middle, closer to the, doing all the right things for your health and wellness. But I do think that to your point, I think sometimes at least someone like me, we can sometimes get into maybe too much of an extreme state where, like I mentioned earlier, and like we talked about in the book, I had not had a hamburger, any sort of ground meat or fried foods in about a decade before I got sick. I mean, everything I ate was just fruits and vegetables and lean meats. And I exercised for hours a day. And that's just because that's sort of how I'm wired and how I was programmed. But I think that, realizing it's okay to sometimes not do that. It was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
And so then what do you get on the other side of that coin as far as how you choose to spend your time?
Yeah, I think that, I guess you could also argue that, making these sorts of decisions, it can also be a slippery slope too, right? All of a sudden you're right on one end of the spectrum and then, the pendulum can really swing. But I do think that, again, this idea that, the answer is somewhere in the middle, and that I think we're in a society that's so polarized today where all of us feel like we know the right answer. And then there's half of the other people in our country that also feel strongly that they know the right answer. And it's not possible for there to be two right answers, maybe in some cases you can have two right answers, but for the most part, I think the answer is somewhere in the middle. And, yeah, I think that going through some of the health things that I've gone through and that you've gone through, I think do help you to realize that fundamentally, we are all a lot more similar than we are different. And, life is a bit too short to really dig our heels in so much in so many issues.
Oh, I so agree. And I love that you brought up that polarizing definitely have the right answer on both sides of the spectrum. Because what occurred to me as you were saying that is if you both think you have the right answers and there can't be two right answers, you're probably both wrong.
Exactly.
Because the answer doesn't lie in the strength, but there's certainly within our American culture, this idea that moderation is not really something that is packaged and sold. And so it's either you're the fitness buff or the couch potato, but you can't be that active. You can't be an active adult. That's not good enough or extreme enough.
You're so right.
And so you get that trade-off of quality of life where, a delicious, I think it was Five Guys, and I'm here for you on the Five Guys burger, every once in a while is exactly what your mind and spirit need, and your body's just going to be okay with it for a day.
That's right.
And then, you know, maybe your mind and spirit isn't like digging on the carrots, but your body is winning. Like, it is this three-legged stool of balance. And you bring a lot of that into your story. This, while this is about chasing your cure and bringing your body and your immune system back online, you really address this mind, body, spirit trifecta of, if you don't have health in all three areas, then what were you fighting to save your body for?
Exactly. And if you don't have the, you know, the relationships with the people you love and the, the time for those people, then yeah, what are you fighting for?
Yeah. Then you could just have a well-oiled machine to be all alone.
Exactly.
It's beautiful. So the other part I want to kind of direct us to a little bit is, you do have a really interesting niche, the way that you're looking at pharmacology and looking at these diseases now. And I wonder if you can give us a little bit of a crash course on what orphan diseases are and why your approach to looking for cures for them is maybe one of the more efficient ways out and through, or through and out.
Sure. Yeah. So there are about 7,000 rare diseases. A definition of a rare orphan disease is that there have to be less than 200,000 people alive with each disease in the U.S. And so with that definition, there are about 7,000 diseases. And just for perspective, and it depends on which disease classification system you use, but for perspective, there are about 10,000 human diseases. 7,000 of them are considered rare or orphan. And among these 7,000 diseases, only about 5% of them have an FDA-approved therapy. And the majority of them are rare genetic diseases where there's a very clear monogenic, you were born with this defect, it causes some very clear downstream problem. But unfortunately, there aren't therapies for a lot of them, in part because they're rare and there are not large markets for drug companies to make drugs for. And so being a rare disease patient, you know, with a disease that was really understudied, I knew that there was no way, and especially also someone who had a limited time frame, I knew that there was no way that I was going to simultaneously identify a new drug and then also do all of the testing and studies to move that forward, to try it in humans and to have it help me and help anyone else, given my limited time frame because I was so sick. But I did know that there were a lot of drugs already FDA approved. I didn't know how many. Now I know there are about 2,500 drugs that are FDA approved. And I knew that they all work in different ways. And I thought to myself, what if one of those drugs that already existed could actually be helpful for my disease? And it's not a new concept. I mean, this idea of drug repurposing is certainly something that's been around for a long time, and it was certainly not my idea. But for me, it was really my only option. There was no way that I could develop a new drug from scratch or that someone else was going to randomly do it. Mm-hmm. And I knew that there was no way I was going to survive unless we identified something that could address my disease. And so this was my only option. And the way I decided to try to find an existing drug that could maybe help me was to first say, what I really need to do is understand what's going on in my immune system. Can I do what's called immunophenotyping? Can I really deeply profile my immune system and compare it to healthy individuals' immune systems and understand what's different, what's going on in mine versus other people? And I found some patterns in the data that made me believe that one part of the immune system, a communication line of the immune system called the mTOR pathway, which mTOR is actually really well known even outside of sort of clinical medicine for the potential role that it has in longevity. So if you treat mice with mTOR inhibitors, they will live longer. If you treat actually any mammal with an mTOR inhibitor, they will live longer than any mammal not on an mTOR inhibitor. And so, but importantly, this part of this communication line, mTOR, is really important for immune cells to turn on, become activated, and to fight things. And we knew that my immune system was turning on, becoming activated, and fighting things for unknown reasons. So it felt like it was a connection here that we could make. And again, with no other options, I thought, well, maybe we should just try treating me with an mTOR inhibitor. And we did. And as I shared, you know, today is 99.97 months that I've been in remission. And so being in remission for this long period of time after having so many deadly relapses on an existing drug has really driven me to say, well, how can we repeat this for other people so that other people aren't out there suffering and even dying from diseases when there's already a drug sitting in your neighborhood pharmacy that just hasn't been utilized?
That's wonderful. And for any of our listeners that want to dive a little bit more into FDA, we did have an interview with Rebecca McBride gosh, it might be close to a year ago. We'll make sure that we throw that up on social media so you can get the flashback on that. But, you know, talking about these studies, we have to have appropriate amount of enrollment to make sure that the drugs don't have side effects. And mm-hmm. with diseases such as your own, finding enough people to make a valid enrollment, really let alone finding them all at the same time in the right, you know, in the right city and bringing them all together is a heroic feat. And so in this way, how nice to, and this is what I just really love and start to obsess about, is when we get down to the foundation of anything that is going on within the body and you find that one pathway, you find that one communication place and say, what kind of treatment or fix can we do on that? You have so many tools at your fingertips instead of saying, let's reinvent the wheel.
Yep. I totally agree with you.
So when you start doing that for other diseases, is do you find that some of these drug applications start to look a little bit different than their original purpose? So the diseases that they're originally made for, some of that, and this is a genuine curiosity on my end, is that some of that starts to look like symptom management. But when you talk about applying this one drug to a very specific part of where your immune system is, it feels like it's kind of getting a little bit into functional medicine there about changing how your body is behaving.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I mean, there's some really great examples of repurposing. I'll just share a few of my favorites. So one of them is a drug called thalidomide. Thalidomide was this horrible drug that caused horrible birth defects and was just terrible. And it was actually taken off the market because of how awful it was.
The anti-nausea medication for mothers.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It was thought to be I guess it is anti-nausea, but of course it came with these horrible birth defects in children. And then fast forward about 20 or 30 years, and a researcher in Little Rock, Arkansas, thought that maybe it could be helpful against a really bad form of cancer called multiple myeloma. And so he just sprinkled some thalidomide on his myeloma cells in a dish, and it killed all the cells. And anyway, they pursued that drug further and did clinical studies and showed that it's actually one of the most effective multiple myeloma treatments in history of really myeloma, but also really one of the more effective cancer treatments of all time. And this is an example where this drug was not made for myeloma. It was, of course, made for morning sickness, anti-nausea for pregnant women. And was horrible in that use, but now actually this lifesaver for myeloma. Another good example of a drug that's certainly well known is sildenafil or Viagra, which of course, you know, we all know its initial intended use, but it also turns out that it's really effective for a rare respiratory issue called pulmonary arterial hypertension. It's really effective for young children with PAH. And so it was sort of rebranded for those kids. And then, of course, other examples are things like aspirin, which was first just a pain reliever. And then we figured out that it actually lowers your risk of stroke. And so these sorts of things oftentimes happen by chance and by luck. You know, if that doctor in Little Rock, Arkansas had never tried to sprinkle thalidomide on these cancer cells, and there literally would be millions of people who would have died and would not have benefited from the drug, I guess, unless someone else sprinkled it on some cancer cells. But these sort of random chance happenings, they both make me really thankful that they happen, but they also make me really frustrated to say, wait a minute, why does it have to happen so randomly? And you know, why does a med student like me need to get Castleman disease to figure out that mTOR, this particular communication line, is really important to Castleman's, then use an mTOR inhibitor? You know, like, you know, we spend billions of dollars a year on medical research, and we've got to figure out ways to make these sorts of insights happen much more automatically.
Well, and I think you touched a little bit on some of the unfortunate motivation around it is having a population where that drug can pay off. I mean, when you talk about having a new creation of a drug, and we talked about this a little bit in our FDA episode, is that it's really expensive to go through that research process, and there better be a return on investment for that drug.
Yep.
And so, again, looking at what we have existing, when we have, how many drugs did you say were on the market?
About 2,500.
So when we have, you know, 250,000 drugs, you know, to even have a place that goes, okay, how can we get more out of this? And how can we even, in a way, I think it has a double-edged gift there where you get to study the side effects. So, you know, the side effects of thalidomide being improper fetal development. terrible side effect. There are so many drugs out there that have really aggressive side effects, but those side effects might be the key to, okay, so we don't want to stop tissue development in fetuses. We do want to stop tissue development in cancer.
Cancer. Yep.
Can we redirect?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, I love that. That's a great point. And yeah, I should do some more digging to figure out, was it that insight? You know, what was the reason that that doctor decided to sprinkle it on those cancer cells? And was it that sort of, you know, very hypothesis driven, like, I know it did this in the fetus, so let me try it in these cancer cells. And those sorts of things, I think we have to figure out a way to harness those insights and really push them forward.
I agree. And what a gift to have someone so driven by it. And it's always that why, but I think it comes a little bit from what we were talking about at the top of the show, is just, I won't put words in your mouth, but I have found consistently that you wouldn't wish this on anyone else. But now that you've been through it, the gift of the struggle is a life that you wouldn't set down. Yeah. And so having that purpose driven in a place that you know and feel in a way that you're not ever going to put aside, I mean, that's the gift that you can bring from the experience that you lived through.
I love that. I think you didn't put words in my mouth, but I love how you put that.
Thank you. Well, so now you're bringing this to COVID treatment, to COVID-19 treatment. I wasn't sure from your biography and the information that we got. Are you talking about, you know, now as we're kind of on the backside of the pandemic and the virus has mutated itself to be, well, very virulent, not particularly aggressive anymore, which we love it. That's what they're meant to do. Good job, COVID. But the long haul piece is still hanging around. Were you speaking about the initial really aggressive forms of the virus? Or are you talking about the long haul, which I know has gotten a new, very Latin sounding name that I don't know yet?
both of them. And the Latin sounding name is PASC, PASC, post-acute sequelae of COVID-19, PASC, which yes, I could, there's certainly a Latin root word that we're thinking of. So really for us, we started up in March of 2020 to creating what's called the Corona Project, to bring together data on all drugs that were being utilized in COVID patients around the world. Because what we found is that there were a lot of drugs being used, but there was no sort of central repository of what was being used and how well it was working and not working. And so what you were left with was a bunch of experts and non-experts reading papers and picking out some drugs that they liked and others that they didn't like, and no sort of very systematic algorithm to be applied across all. So we did that. So we basically bring in all data on all drugs for use for COVID, and then we apply the same algorithm across all the data to say what drugs look promising, what drugs don't look promising, not what's your favorite drug or what's your political party that makes you like one drug or another. Really just let's apply the same filter to everything. And so doing that, we've been able to identify a number of, we grade them like school grades. And so it's like A, B, C, D's. And we found a bunch of A's and B's, and then in C's and D's, of course. But among the A's and B's, with B's being the ones that we focus on the most, B meaning that there's reason to believe they're going to be effective, but there haven't been big enough studies to prove that they work or don't work. And so those are sort of like the really exciting ones for us. The A's, they look really effective. They've been shown to be effective. It's big studies. But the B's are the exciting ones. And we've been able to work with the NIH and the FDA to launch clinical trials where we use the bees as a starting point. We say, these are the 50 or so bees. Let's dig into which of these bees look the most promising, and let's make sure that a large trial is done to demonstrate whether they actually work or not. And one of those studies is called the Active Six Study, which the NIH funded. It was about a $115 million trial. And something I'm really proud of is that before the Corona Project was involved, the plan for Active Six was to pick drugs based on drugs that were proposed to the panel. You know, what drugs should we include? And then we got a handful of proposals. But I was really thrilled that we were able to say, well, let's not just pick among the handful that are proposed. Let's look at all of the promising drugs from this really, you know, broad database, and let's pick the best drugs from them. And we did that. And so this sort of idea of bringing data and rigor to selecting drugs for trials is something that I'm just really proud of.
Well, I think that's wonderful because, you know, you touched on something that unfortunately, you know, the fact of the matter is how politicized yes. the coronavirus became. And so your drug options are the things that you would consider doing kind of put you in line with political affiliation that may or may not have actually been accurate. And so stepping outside of all of that and finally having a conversation where you can say, listen, there can be early treatment. There can be things that we do before, you know, you're just so decompensated, yeah. you're on ventilator and good luck to you. I mean, to have had that consistent conversation down the middle, I think would have been really comforting to a lot of Americans, a lot of people globally.
I think so. And I think that individuals on both sides of the political spectrum, I think we're both too quick to shoot down certain things, mm-hmm. but also too slow to realize when other things weren't working. And this sort of like, and sort of inverse, right? Depending mm-hmm. on which political party you're in, I could ask you what you think about drugs for COVID, and I could immediately tell you which political party you're in, which, you know, this kind of goes to what we're talking about at the beginning of the conversation, mm-hmm. that, you know, that's just not the way it should be, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the medicine should be, you know, apolitical, it should be unbiased. And unfortunately, that was certainly not the case with COVID. And so, yeah, we just felt that it was really important to have a data set. And the best part about Corona, I think, mm-hmm. is you can actually click on the studies to understand why it got a grade A, B, C, or D. And so you can see the data. And it's a very clear algorithm. We apply the same algorithm to all drugs. And you can actually look at the studies behind it. So it's not, you know, someone sitting in a room coming up with grades because mm-hmm. they like one thing or another. It's just the data that's talking. And that's kind of how it should be beyond COVID. Mm-hmm. And I think fortunately outside of COVID, that kind of is how it is because it isn't, you know, the hot topic that everyone's, you know, looking at all day, every day. So I think it is a bit more apolitical, but I think there are more things that could be done to make sure that data don't languish, that, you know, people don't do a lot of work to generate data from a study and then it just kind of sits on the sidelines. Let's make sure that we harness all the data we can.
I love that. And it brings up, and so I guess I should ask, is the Corona Project available to anybody to look at for lay people, or is this really
anyone?
Just
anyone? Yeah. If you go to cdcn.org/corona, mm-hmm. cdcn.org/corona, you can access the entire database, all of the papers, all of the data points, everything for every drug. I think we're over 600 drugs now have been given to COVID patients, which is pretty amazing. Over 600 drugs. And I know something that you'd be certainly interested in checking out as well is something that we felt very strongly about is that it didn't matter what the intervention was, whether it was a pharmacologic intervention or whether it was natural intervention, whatever it was, it needed mm-hmm. to be in the Corona Project. Because I think that it's a lot of times individuals, you know, in Western medicine will sort of say, I'm only going to look at the pharmacologic agents. I'm not going to look at the non-pharmacologic mm-hmm. ones. But, you know, that's a slippery slope, in my opinion. And I think that, the idea that something is only going to be active in a disease if it's, you know, a prescription medication, I think is wrong. And mm-hmm. so we were very clear from the beginning. So you'll actually find a lot of agents in there that are not pharmacologic, but that certainly have activity.
Oh, I love that. I think that is such a great inclusion. I really appreciate that you bring that because it is true. And I don't, at this point, I don't even know where the political line lies around this, but it is, you got doctors on all sides of the spectrum, but yes. having this idea, you know, I've been told that, you know, if fruit and vegetables worked, we wouldn't need pharmacological interventions. And there are a lot of places where, and I saw this come up, and I'd be curious how you want to weigh in on this from all the study you've done, but you know, we have something, we talk about coronavirus as being such an important part of our immune system. And if your immune system is completely suppressed, because perhaps you don't get any sun, so vitamin D was a big topic of conversation. And we saw huge correlations between low vitamin D levels and severity of COVID outcomes. So it's a change in language to say vitamin D isn't going to cure your COVID syndrome, but it's going to make your body stronger. It's a whole different way of researching, but really bio-individual and really important to consider.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. There's incredibly strong correlative data showing that individuals who have low vitamin D when they get COVID have worse outcomes. Mm-hmm. Also individuals who had low vitamin D a year before they got COVID. So if you go back in their medical records and you find people, what their vitamin D levels were a year ago before they ever got COVID, people who had low vitamin D a year ago have bad outcomes with COVID. what's challenging is that there haven't been many good studies to say, okay, having an appropriate vitamin D level is clearly better than having a low vitamin D level when you get COVID. What we don't know is once you get COVID, does taking vitamin D improve your outcome? Because it might be too little too late, right? Mm-hmm. And so there were a couple conflicting studies early on in the pandemic. One of them was done in Spain that sort of knocked everyone's socks off. And that's where there was this massive reduction in mortality among individuals who got vitamin D versus didn't get vitamin D. And I, like many others, were really excited about it. One flaw with that study was that rather than randomly assigning patients to either get vitamin D or not get vitamin D, they gave entire floors of the hospital vitamin D, or a whole other floor of the hospital no vitamin D. But hospitals are often segregated based on how sick people are. And so, you know, different floors are usually for sicker people than other floors, especially in COVID times when you're really concerned about isolation. And so there appears to be a potential major bias that was introduced. What you really should do is just randomly assign, you know, you get a sugar pill, you get vitamin D on every floor of the hospital. It shouldn't be like the ICU gets, you know, gets no vitamin D and everyone else gets vitamin D, which is what it sounds like happened in that particular study in Spain. And then there was another flawed study that was done, I believe it was in Colombia, in the other direction, where all they did was give one pill of vitamin D. They gave 100,000 international units of vitamin D, one dose, right after people got COVID. And as you know, 100,000 units is a mammoth amount of vitamin D. But and what they found from that study was that there was no difference in outcomes between the people who got the single dose versus not the single dose. But I argue that it's also flawed because, you know, maybe if you took a little bit every day for 2 weeks, then maybe you'd do better than getting this one 100,000 units. And so, you know, you got one study in Spain that looked to be positive when maybe it was, you know, not appropriately done. Then you got a study in another part of the country, part of the world that looked to be negative. But again, I don't think it was appropriately done. And that's kind of the challenge that we all face, because we would see the headlines, right? And the headline shows this, the next headline shows that. And there's unfortunately so much nuance in this stuff that makes it really complicated.
Yeah. And so having a database like you've created where we can take a look at and say outside the headline, all of them, because it is just the one where you have to like almost have a degree to in medicine to be able to find your way through this. And because you know, it's that one word about preventing or outcomes. So, you know, you hear people saying, well, vitamin D doesn't help help you overcome COVID. Is it? Well, take it now because you're healthy. And it's the difference between singular words and the way that that gets spun into the media outlets. Again, depending on which channel you're watching, it doesn't matter which channel you're watching, it's still overwhelmingly biased, where you're missing out on some really good puzzle pieces.
Totally. I totally agree with you.
That's fantastic. So I love this. We'll make sure we put that in the show notes so that everybody can take a look at it. Again, even as we are kind of winding our way out of this being the hot topic on the news stations all the time, it's still a fantastic resource. And when you take a look at what all of the options are, there are still some pretty nasty cases going around. It might be useful to you and your family, but it's also an opportunity, and this is my hope, that we can look back on the last 2 years and learn from how we acted in this knee-jerk of fear. It was a terrifying situation, you know, coming into early 2020 and unprecedented, and nobody knows what they're doing. And I think we really showed that nobody knows what they're doing in how our fear response is. And so having a database set up like this is kind of a nice blueprint to start with. Okay, we didn't have a central piece for this one. What are we going to do next time?
Yep, I totally agree with you.
So what are your hopes of kind of taking these lessons of the last 2 years and what you know about disease research and application that you hope kind of carry forward and maybe hope to see in the difference of how the medical community interacts with healthcare at large?
Yeah, I think that in at least a sort of a myopic focus on the things that I do and I'm focused on, I really would like to figure out ways to centralized data from many different diseases, not just so kind of using COVID as the example, but realizing that there's a lot of really great data that just kind of falls to the wayside. It's almost like waste or garbage that never gets picked up, and just kind of data everywhere. And what I'd love to do is figure out ways that we can harness the data that are out there. And then apply algorithms that are unbiased to figure out which data and which drugs or diseases mm-hmm. look most promising, and then figure out ways to move those insights forward to clinical trials, really like what we did for COVID. But realizing that COVID is this extreme example where, as I mentioned, over 600 drugs have been given to patients in the last couple of years. If you look at any other disease in the history of humankind, there's mm-hmm. never been a disease that's had 600 drugs tried on it, especially not in 2 years. You know, I mean, it, you know, if you're lucky, you have a handful of drugs being studied within a 2 year period for a disease. So it's unique in that way. But I think that's even more of a reason that we need to harness every single data point for other diseases where there aren't, you know, sort of this surplus of drugs being tested. We really got to make sure you make the most of each drug that's being studied for every disease.
And I think that is such a great, I mean, it's simple and it's foundational, but the impactfulness of having that kind of database. I remember you mentioning in your book, as you're looking for research on Castleman's, you know, you thought you were, your first hospital you were in had brilliant doctors. And I think you chose it because, you know, family members and knowing so much about that hospital service, but they didn't have the specificity. You were still without that central set of knowledge until you found another doctor in another city. Yeah. And I know a lot of people, especially, you know, and this is a little segue into, well, I mean, Castleman is that autoimmune, but into autoimmune and into chronic disease yeah. is the emotional labor and legwork of these patients who often aren't gifted with being in their doctoral programs like you and I were as we're trying yeah. to figure this out.
Yep.
Are trying to make their way through the internet and Dr. Google and DuckDuckGo and all of these different places to gather information in these one-off studies about, you know, for me, this is what a traumatic brain injury benefits from over here and over here and over here. And I have to make that decision myself. And if I didn't know all the language that I learned, it's a Herculean feat to ask people who just want their lives back.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. No, you're totally right. And I wish we had a good solution for that, right? You know, I think mm-hmm. that unfortunately, the best solution I've come up with is trying to find an advocacy organization for your particular condition to help you to go in the right direction. You know, they may not have all of the answers, but usually they've got the right doctors that mm-hmm. you can go see. And they don't always have the right doctors, but they usually do. And at least that helps to kind of get started, you know, okay, mm-hmm. I've got this disease, I've got this injury. I'm going to check out the organization that's advocating for this. And then I'm going to follow through and see who that they recommend as a doctor. That's kind of a good first step, but it's just a first step. Mm-hmm. To your point, you've got to continue to advocate for yourself. You'll then potentially either read online or you'll learn from a doctor about one treatment approach or another treatment approach. And you'll have to start weighing those sorts of decisions. And that's where I think just finding a doctor who's really open-minded is really, really important.
I love that. And I think that open-mindedness of any provider that you have is really the best gift, because whatever you're going to be bringing to the table, if you have one of these more obscure understudied conditions, is it's not going to be something anybody's ever heard of before. And very often that is the place of shutdown in care of, oh, I've never heard of that before. Let's move on. And you need someone who's willing to pick it up and look at it with you.
I totally agree.
Wonderful. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us today, sharing so much of your story. This really is an incredible book, an incredible story, Chasing My Cure. Where can our listeners pick up their own copy?
Sure. Well, you can pick up copy anywhere books are sold, your favorite local bookstore, Amazon. You can go to chasingmycure.com. We actually have autographed copies on the website that you can get there. But yeah, as I said before, I wrote this book because I learned so much about life from nearly dying. Lessons that have just fundamentally changed who I am. And so the idea that listeners can read the book or listen to the audiobook and learn these lessons without having to go through what I went through, that makes me really happy.
That's wonderful. And it is such a great gift. I mean, looking at these kind of things, the way that we talked about it, you don't have to come to the brink to take away some of these pieces. Looking at where you find quality in your life, putting things in perspective about what do you want to be remembered for and what relationships are important to you. Something we never circled back around on, but another common thread that I am finding, and you brought up in your book, was using humor to look suffering in the eye. And the way that can help us bring us closer to what we're struggling with instead of distancing from it. Actually, I'll invite you to touch on that quickly because I love that aspect.
Sure. Yeah, I found, and I learned this from my mom when she was going through her cancer, just that laughing with the people you love during really tough times, at least for us, was really healing, and it was really exactly what we needed. Not to say that her brain cancer or my Castleman disease were funny or a joke, but to say that like finding humor and things that were happening, as you know from the book, at one stage I was confused as my father's pregnant wife because of the liver and kidney failure. I had this huge belly, and a drunk gentleman on New Year's Eve looked at me and my dad and said, "Good luck to you and your wife." And then I looked at my belly and I realized he thought that I was my dad's pregnant wife. And, you know, that could have been a really low point where like, I just like went to my hospital room and just cried, but we like cried with laughter and we laughed together. And my dad and I really connected on that. And there were a number of experiences with my mom where something happened because of her brain cancer, which certainly was not a laughing matter, but we laughed together about it. And it was just, it was sort of like, this is awful. Your brain cancer is awful. My Castleman is awful, but like, we're going to transcend the awfulness by laughing together with the people we love. And I've just found that in the midst of my toughest times, the times when you would think there's nothing to laugh about, that's the time when you really do need to laugh.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I couldn't agree more. And it takes this mantle off of taking everything so seriously.
Yeah.
Because we can't live with that, you know, specter of death floating over your shoulder the whole time without turning around and just laughing at it for wasting its time chasing you. You know, it's like, I'll get there eventually. Just let me go have my baby. No, we need to have these moments of levity, and you're so right about how it brings into community. And I know, the Dr. Znigowski brought up a huge point around burnout and closing that stress cycle just with laughter and community and some of these genuine emotions that can take us outside of stress and fear. So even without, huge life-changing events, I think that's a little gift that we can all bring to our lives is a little bit more levity.
I agree.
Dr. David Finkbaum, thank you again for joining us. We so appreciate you having you here. And to all of our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in and listening to another episode. Again, there's so many little pieces that we can use to improve the quality of our life without having to face dramatic life-ending experiences. I hope that you can learn a little something from our conversation or pick up a copy of Chasing My Cure. There's a lot of heartwarming stories and eye-opening experiences waiting for you there. In the meantime, we'll see you next week for another episode of Healing Ground Movement Podcast. Be well. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard and got a little something out of it to help you on your journey to health. Please, if you're inclined, share this podcast with a friend so we can help more people lead healthier lives. Now, remember, the information expressed in these interviews is for informational and not diagnostic or treatment purposes. However, I hope you find that having the right information and resources can go a long way to helping you on your healthcare journey. Ask the right questions and seek out professional help. And we'll see you next week for another episode of the Healing Ground Movement Podcast. Be well.